So it turns out that it is hard to unplug from this worldwide network of communication, even in the Philippines. At various times during my visit there, I found myself glued to CNN as the pursuit of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects unfolded. I found myself staring at my iPad, looking at email, or waiting for the next Packers pick in the NFL draft. I found myself downloading pictures on Facebook. I found myself in line at a mall cinema with a throng of people to watch the debut of Iron Man 3, which in fact did debut in the Philippines a week before here. What a contrast from my experience in Sri Lanka back in 1983, when the only way to plug in was through snail mail, which took months. The only movie I saw in Sri Lanka was The Shining, 3 years after it came out in the United States. Now, it wasn't as easy to plug in the Philippines as here. I shut down the texting and the cellular data piece of my phone, and so I couldn't just whip out my phone whenever I wanted to find out some fact that I unexpectedly needed to know. Not that this stopped me from trying from time to time. Now, I have to say that I'm not someone who is just categorically opposed to plugging in. I acknowledge that there is much to recommend it. For example, it was really wonderful to be able to download pictures that you could see while I was there. But there is a cost to constantly being plugged in. It does produce a cacophony of music, images, news, data, information. I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I'm drowning in it. So my life is enhanced to a point by plugging in, but I seem to habitually cross that point of enhancement into overload. There is an addictive quality to being plugged in that makes it difficult to avoid going over this line. In fact, evidence has surfaced that being plugged in all the time begins to change how our brain works. There was an article, a column in the New York Times just this morning about how we're actually dumber when we're trying to multitask, but that our brain is rewiring itself to not be quite as dumb as it was initially. And so this becomes our normal way of relating to the world. I have to admit, in the first service today, during the meditation time, I found myself thinking, I wonder what the difference is between a typhoon and a hurricane. And I was actually thinking, you know, if you weren't all looking, I would get out my phone and find out. So what I want to suggest today is that many of us, certainly me, need to moderate the ways and the extent to which we're plugged in. And I'm not saying we all need to unplug cold turkey. I'm not asking you to throw your cell phones in the pond on your way out. But I think we need to create more space for silence in the world, more space for being unplugged. And I think that this is not likely to happen by accident. It only will happen if we think about it and then are intentional and, dare I say, disciplined. Three sanctuaries of silence come to mind as I think about trying to create more space for silence in my life. The first of these is a quiet lake up north in Wisconsin. Shoe Lake is about a 20-minute walk from my little place in the Nicolet National Forest. Shoe Lake's a rather large lake, and there's only two human dwellings on it. And what's more, there's not an easy boat access. In fact, the only boat I've ever seen on it is the kayak that I've been paddling. Well, at least once a winter, I like to go up there and hike to Shoe Lake and stand by the shore. And so as I hike along, of course, my feet make noise every step I make in the sound, in the snow. So I walk along, trudging along, and then I go off the path and down to the shore of the lake over through heavy snow. And then I just stop, and I stand as still as I possibly can. So the sound of my footsteps have ceased, and there is no other sound. The leaves are all off the trees, so even the wind is silent. The lake is frozen, so there's no waves lapping ashore. And usually it's so remote that I can't hear cars, I can't hear snowmobiles. All is quiet. Absolutely quiet. The silence is stunning. It's arresting. It's like Annie Dillard's image in the call to gather that Deb shared, where it hits me on the side of my head. And I hold my breath so that even that sound ceases for a moment. For me, it is a sacred moment. There is an expansiveness that fills my soul. And honestly, that one moment can get me through the long winter. And my second sanctuary of silence, in fact, isn't silent at all. But it was an unplugged experience. Last summer, Amy and I went on a backpacking trip up in the San Juan Mountains near Silverton, Colorado. We left the main road and we drove up this unpaved, pockmarked road up, 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 until we got to a trailhead. We parked near the trailhead and then we hiked up 3.5 miles, 3,000 feet, to the lower Ice Lake Basin. We parked on the side of the road then and made this journey up, carrying everything we needed on our back for four days and four nights. And we found in this lower basin a very isolated spot, out of earshot, out of eyesight of other campers. We camped in a stand of trees near a waterfall, so it was not silent. The water was flowing 24/7. But from that place, we could hike up another 1,000 feet to the upper basin and there see some of the most beautiful, peaceful mountain lakes I've ever seen. And our timing was perfect. We happened to hit the upper basin at the very peak of wildflower season. And maybe best of all, we were out of range in terms of our cell phones. There was no point in even turning on the phone. There was no signal. So for 4 days, we were blissfully unplugged. It was just Amy and me and the astonishing beauty and peacefulness of the mountain basins resplendent in wildflowers. Nothing distracted from the beauty that was enveloping us. And in its own way, there was a silence to the place. There was no cell phones ringing, no TV, no cars, no lawnmowers, no music. Just the sounds of the wind and the waterfall and the afternoon thunderstorms. Only the occasional drone of a jet overhead reminded us that it wasn't 1812 or 1212, but it was 2012. And then the third sanctuary of silence was one I found last week in Bodaibodai in our partner church village. Like the Ice Lake Basin in Colorado, it wasn't silent. There was actually plenty of noise, but it was unplugged. There was no cell phone signal. There was no internet in Bodaibodai. So Bodaibodai is a village of about 3,000 people. It feels even smaller because it's divided into an upper village and a lower village. Our partner church is located on the edge of the lower village. My traveling companion, the Reverend Don Southworth, and I arrived around 6 in the evening, and we were about an hour and a half late, yet everybody in the church, maybe more, were all waiting for us outside the church. The scene as we climbed out of the minivan was one I will long cherish and remember. Everyone rushing forward to shake our hands, the kids reaching to bring our hands up to their forehead in a symbol of respect. It felt like a homecoming, even though I'd never been there. It felt like these were family, like I knew these people deeply. The joy and the love was palpable, it was moving, and it stayed with us through the whole 19 hours we were in Bodaibodai. Those 19 hours were among the most remarkable and magical of my life. Once we made our way through that throng outside the church, we all went inside and we settled onto these narrow wood, really hard pews, no backs, few plastic chairs. I got to be in a plastic chair. And we settled down for a welcoming program. Love and joy and hospitality filled the room and it filled our hearts. My friend Don commented later that If every Unitarian Universalist congregation in this country was as welcoming, as joyous, as B'nai, we'd be the largest denomination in the country. I think he's right. So our partners put a lot into the welcome program. It actually went on for hours with a break for dinner. Many of the congregation's children, and there were a ton of them, shared talents. Don and I were invited to share our talent too, and that was presumed to be the chicken dance, which it was. Our earlier pilgrims had introduced it there, and so we did the chicken dance. The night was just full of laughter and exhilaration and joy and a few tears. Finally, Don's and my exhaustion became evident in spite of our best efforts to hide it. So it was time for bed. We slept on a bamboo bed, no mattress, right there in the church in the religious education room that our fellowship helped finance. Several church members, I don't know how many, slept in the sanctuary on the floor through the night so we didn't feel too alone and isolated. All night long, the CD player played music, hushed voices made conversation. The congregational president brought over an oscillating fan that happily droned all night, keeping us cool and the bugs off. And around 4:45 in the morning, the roosters started to crow. I put in earplugs, but it didn't work. It felt like there were 10 roosters right around our bed. Time to rise. And then came my favorite part of the visit to B'nai, the morning. While Don meditated for a little bit, I ventured outside. I talked to some of the men in the churchyard, and then the sun beautifully rose, casting a light, a glow on the church. One of the church's ministers, a man named Giovanni, invited me over to his nearby house. So we walked over there, and his house was made, a small hut really, made of bamboo with a corrugated metal roof. Most of the houses, all the houses, are made of bamboo there, some thatched roofs, some corrugated. A handyman, Giovanni, had built his house himself. Giovanni's wife, Jonabeth, sells Avon products, so sort of incongruously on the side of this bamboo house was the sign, "Authorized Avon Dealer." The house was raised, and so I had to actually climb up a ladder to get into it. And beneath the house was the kitchen, a table, a sink, and an area to cook, which was basically cooked on a wood fire. I sat and talked with Giovanni for a while and his family in the sitting room of their house. After a delightful visit with them, Don joined, and we started walking around the village. Even though it was barely 6 a.m., it was already scorchingly hot. We were drenched in sweat instantly. We walked along a dirt road. Each side there were sugarcane stalks towering above us. Our first destination was the water source outside the village. This is the lifeblood of the village. Several women were there washing clothing as we came by. I later learned that the village doesn't get enough water from the water source. Some of it does come down and it comes through hoses into various parts of the village, but there's not enough pressure. They're hoping the next election changes the political calculus and they get a little more water pressure. From the water source, we continued our walk. One of the church members had a big knife, and so we stopped and she cut down a couple of the sugarcane stalks and she whittled around down the ends and then gave them to us to gnaw on. What a delicious, sweet flavor that was. We made our way to the congregation president's house. There we had a pre-breakfast snack of chicken, pasta, and fruit. I had earlier shared that I have a deep love for fresh coconut juice, so the snack was capped by going out in the front yard. One of the church members used that knife and split a coconut in half, and Don and I each got to drink the very refreshing juice out of the coconut. Then we walked through that part of the village which was thickly settled, and we then went back to the church. We had breakfast, and then we continued our tour by going to the elementary school, the high school, and an agriculture project. Throngs of children joined us for the school tours and the head teacher. They were all so proud of the school. One of the things that caught my eye at the high school was the basketball court, uneven dirt and grass. Can you imagine dribbling on that? We ended up back at the church for the morning worship service, and as we sat down to begin the service, the two ministers, Giovanni and Wina, looked at me and said, "So will you do the sermon?" Okay. The children's song, "Love Grows One by One, Two by Two," thankfully popped into my mind, and I used that as a text. Love grows one by one, two by two, four by four. Love grows round like a circle and comes back knocking at our front door. And I shared with them, this is the beauty of these partnerships. Love keeps coming round in a circle and knocking at our front door here at the fellowship and in B'nai B'nai and in Deva. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Following the service, we exchanged gifts with each other, and this was highlighted by my presenting to our B'nai B'nai partners the gifts that we had from our Deva Transylvania partners, a beautiful wood carving and an embroidery. And I could tell they were so moved by this that once they began to figure out where the gift came from through the translation, they all just burst into spontaneous applause. We then had lunch, we said our goodbyes, climbed back into the van, and our trip to B'nai B'nai was over. So as I reflect on it, lots of things contributed to the magic of that visit. Not unimportant among them was the fact that I was completely unplugged. Distractions were not available to me in the form of my phone or my iPad. I was able to fulfill my desire to be completely present in the moment, connected with our friends there. And though B'nai B'nai is not a silent place, but there was a quality of silence that nonetheless pervaded it, just as much for me as standing by Shoe Lake or being up in the Ice Lake Basin. And it is that silence which I desperately need in my life. Why do I need it? Why do we need it? Maybe more than anything, that quality of silence opens up our imaginations. Silence, as Kathleen Norris writes in the reading that Deb shared, is silence liberates our imaginations. And so when we live totally plugged in lives, we drown in this cacophony of information and data and media, and our imaginations just shut down. We don't need them. Iron Man 3 will do our imagining for us in its overwhelmingly loud and vivid way, and even in 3D if we want. And so the din of contemporary life in the United States and much of the world now actually, I think, drowns out our imagination. And I think this is killing us. Many times I don't even think we can imagine a better world. All we can imagine are terrorists and bombs and the hatred that we see on CNN or Iron Man 3. And it's interesting how too the CNN depictions, how similar the CNN depictions in news coverage of the Boston bombing, how similar that was to Iron Man 3. There's a bombing scene in Iron Man 3 that just seems like it's the end of the Boston Marathon all over. So the occasional movie about a Lincoln or a Gandhi or a Mandela reminds us that there are other possibilities out there, but these get overwhelmed by all the mayhem in the movies. Go home today. Look at your listings for the movie listings, the movies locally. Mayhem. Most of them just have mayhem. And after a while, that's all we can imagine in our minds. When I stand by Shoe Lake in utter silence, or I sit among the resplendent wildflowers up in the Ice Lake Basin, or I walk around B'nai B'nai connected with these new friends in their home, I find my imagination opens up. I can begin to imagine what it might be like to live a centered, open, peaceful, truly connected life, connected to other people and places. I imagine new possibilities for my life and for the world. My creative juices start flowing. And I don't want to romanticize being unplugged. In B'nai B'nai, our partners desperately want to buy an antenna, a large antenna that will connect them and their cell phones. They have gotten tired of walking far outside the village, up on a hill, trying to get a cell phone image so they or a cell phone signal so that they can connect with their church headquarters and through their headquarters with us. I can well imagine that they would love to get a computer and to be able to connect to the internet. I don't begrudge these desires. I just hope the next time I'm in B'nai B'nai, if they have that cell phone antenna, that I don't think, hey, great, I'm going to turn on my phone and connect. I hope I leave my phone off. And so this brings me back to intentionality. What I need in my life is more intentionality about plugging in and unplugging. The challenge for me is to find sanctuaries of silence in my everyday life. I cannot always fly across the world to the Philippines and jump in a van and drive for hours over treacherous dirt roads to get to B'nai B'nai. I can't always get on a plane, fly to Denver, rent a car, drive 8 hours, hike up 3.5 miles to the Ice Lake Basin. I can't even always drive up north 2 hours. That's actually the easy part, finding sanctuaries like that. What I need to do that's harder is find sanctuaries of silence here in my own everyday life. And today I don't have a lot of new or dramatic ideas, but here are some things I'm thinking about trying. One is forcing myself not to pull out my phone when I'm talking to someone and find myself curious about a fact. Instead, I want to keep the phone away and try to connect with the person in the same way I connected with people in B'nai B'nai. Another idea is to take occasional Sabbaths from being plugged in. Maybe on an evening when I'm home and don't have a meeting. Maybe on Sunday afternoons and evenings after our services. And yet another idea is to discipline myself about when I look at email from work, to actually do it when I'm working and not when I'm home. I know that I can develop some more intentional practices in terms of plugging in and unplugging. I'll be curious to hear during the response if you have found things that work for you. And here's what I know. The health of my spirit and my imagination, and I think those are inextricably linked, the health of those things might well depend on my figuring this out. As the little North Dakota girl wrote after Kathleen Norris's experience of noise and silence, silence reminds me to take my soul wherever I go. This is exactly what I need to do in my life. How about you?